Welcome to the Angular Plus Show, where app developers of all kinds share their insights and experiences. Let's get started.
kilograms, that is 341 pounds for those of us that are graduated to the metric system. So how many times do you push that?
I pushed it over four lengths of 12 and a half meters, so 50 meters in total.
Oh my gosh. And so, okay, so if any of you have not met the prowler or the like the training sled, like, so for example, I push this thing in a like a boot camp class that I do with the other moms in town. And I usually push about 100 pounds on that. And that feels like excessively heavy. So that's like 45 kilograms. So you push it and then you go run?
Yeah, you have to run before and after for 1 kilometer. And there are other strength stations as well. So you have to patience yourself to not be burned out directly after.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because if you're not somebody who's ever done any lifting, when you engage those large muscle groups, like your thigh muscles particularly, it really sucks the life out of you. Like it takes every spare molecule of oxygen in your body and uses it right up. And so,
'cause that area has like the most muscle, right? Like your thigh and like your butt.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
Especially your calves as well. So
I always forget about those guys and they're really important in that. Like you definitely feel it. So what's that?
Yeah, you have to believe that this thing is going forward. Otherwise it will stay on the ground and no chance.
Oh, right, I love that. So it's like a lot of a mental game too, right?
Right.
Also, the first time I pushed this weight, it was not moving. And many of my team members, they wanted to compete, but did not dare so far because they are scared of this weight.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Does everyone push the same weight or is it based on like each person?
There are two groups. One is the pro category, which is like RX and CrossFit, so the heavyweights. Mm-hmm. And then there's a beginner's weight section as well, which is 30% reduced. Okay. But other than that, pro women have the same weight than normal men. And there's pro men as well, and it's even heavier. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh,
man.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's like, that's crazy.
And okay, I have to ask, like, I have all these, just from like sitting around and typing and like, I don't do a whole lot that's like physically active, but I have a lot of like back problems. Does lifting like help with things like that? Or does it make it worse?
Yeah, I think it helps tremendously. I mean, really? I was into sports until I was 25 or so, when I was sitting in front of the computer all day.
Yeah.
And then I started first with running and then with strength training as well. And since then, no more back or neck pain. So
really? Wow.
Yeah, I can kind of like keep my problems at bay by exercising, even just like going out for a walk. It's like it massages, like it moves your spine the way your spine is supposed to move.
Well, I'm not sure for me, because I feel like I've done bouts where I did a lot of like yoga and rock climbing. During both those periods, I did have like pretty regular neck and back pain or like pinched nerves, things like that. And so I'm trying to find like a good balance of like an activity that will help me with it instead of making it worse.
Yeah. And I have to say, like with the lighter weight lifting that I do, I still do have days where I get myself pretty sore, but it's usually like muscle sore. You know, like, oh, I pushed that a little too far and I can't sit on the toilet.
pinched nerves are sort of like a different beast.
Yeah, yeah.
It might just
it's
be
interesting
part of them.
Though. But you know, it's like the human body is meant to move, and it definitely complains when we don't.
Yeah.
So you started running. What got you into what is the sport called? It's not quite CrossFit,
it's
right?
Hyrox. Like, it's Hyrox. It's not quite CrossFit. Yeah. Actually, I started last year.
Because, oh wow.
Yeah. I mean, I started CrossFit more or less around 2019, 2020.
Okay.
Get a little bit of push into my running speed. Mm-hmm. And then I was injured during lockdown and totally committed to CrossFit. Yeah. But then I found out I can do well at strength training as well, and to make the best of both, and to be back in competition, which was not possible for a while. I found this Hyrox and found it very challenging also to convince me to just commit to it, to stick to it, to try the heavyweights. Yeah. I always need some challenge.
Right, wow. Right. And so you were saying that 2 weeks ago, you hit your personal best.
Yeah, I have my personal best now in Hyrox Pro in 1:25. And it's a personal best by 3 minutes. And it was really funny because I almost cut those 3 minutes in the sled push and sled pull. So the heaviest stations. Yeah.
Wow. That is such an accomplishment.
You have to pull the sled too?
Yeah, I have to pull
it. Pull it?
It's 105 kilo on a rope, and it's the same distance. And this is really, for me, worse than push. It's pull.
I'll bet. Oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've never tried to pull it. I'm not going to lie. I normally just push it, and it's like my head is down. I've got sweat pouring, and I'm like, honestly, I'm swearing the entire time. So,
yeah, but especially but I think pull is bad because it doesn't move constantly. It stops, and
you gotta get over that initial inertia of
Wow.
Because I know with the lighter weight, like if I run and like if not like run, that sounds like I'm really like sporty. But like if I like push it faster, it's easier because it has less time to sit on the ground.
Yeah. So, you got the momentum.
But then you burn out a little faster. So it's like are you working the muscle? Like, what are you trying to do? Are you like burning your, like, are you trying to boost your like oxygen levels, or are you trying to like work the muscles? And so it's interesting. I always think that like sports mechanics are so interesting, and just like how like human physiology, like how exercise, you know, like just how it works as it's, cause it's a science, right? There's a science to it, and we can improve our performance. Right. So like we can start out as just, the developer sitting at our desk, and, you know, if we focus on it, we can improve our performance. We can become stronger. We can become faster, which leads us to the topic that we have for you today. So I would love to welcome you all to the Angular Plus Show. It's a podcast where we talk about all things Angular related and Angular adjacent. And today we have our guest, Katrine Muller. Katrine is a full stack developer, architect, and UX and CSS enthusiast working as a principal consultant at TNG Technology Consulting since 2014. She did a PhD in theoretical physics.
Wow.
but she has left science to get more hands-on results. She has broad experience from multiple client projects, ranging from mature enterprise projects, as well as development from scratch. She knows the common pitfalls and a lot of best practices, which she enjoys sharing. And I had the honor of meeting Katrine in Berlin at NGDE. I'm focused on the Berlin conference now, which is coming up. I met Katrine at NGDE, and you gave a really great talk on perceived performance and just improving the performance of Angular applications. And so that's why we've asked you to join us today. But Katrine, would you like to say hi to the listeners, introduce yourself a little?
Yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Katrine Muller. I think you said most about myself. I'm currently, for the last years, deep into Angular and working on different client projects. And as I've seen a lot from different projects, a lot from different colleagues, from different experience levels, I know what's problematic and where is the pain and what is maybe a blind spot in some places.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because, you know, it's hard when you get, you've got your upper business people, they come in and they say, we want the application to be faster. And you say, okay, so what do you, what are some of your, so if you, let's say you start a project, so you do consulting, so I'm sure you've seen a few different projects. So what are some of the, what are some of the first things you look for when you're looking to evaluate the performance in an application?
So it depends in my projects where I'm starting. So sometimes there is no application yet, and I have to start from scratch to create some prototype, create some blueprint. And sometimes there is something, or maybe there's a backend already. And I get told right away, the backend, it's legacy backend, it's very slow. And when I check some calls that we need to fetch some data, indeed, there are very, very legacy calls that take 15 seconds or so. And we have to mask it in the front end. We have to make the illusion of a performant website, no matter how fast or how slow other parts are.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have a lot of listeners who can relate to this. I know that I have certainly dealt with a lot of backends in the past that you know, there's not a whole lot you can do about it because it's just, you know, the older infrastructure, or maybe it's processing a lot of data or retrieving it from, you know, some place that's not easily, not as performant for some reason or another. So I'm really excited about this topic because I think that it's something that we can all learn from.
Yeah, and sometimes you really have to challenge the requirements. Yeah. So sometimes the data we should show is so costly because it takes multiple calls to the backend to combine all the data, and maybe some part of it is irrelevant or not so relevant. And you could speed it up tremendously by showing the bigger parts first and loading some details in the background.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And I think that's such an interesting point. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I apologize to the listener. My connection is really bad today. So if I'm breaking up, bear with me, I guess. But yeah, it's a good point. Like a lot of times with the APIs, we just don't have control over them. So what are some of the strategies that you use when you're faced with that situation?
Yeah, for example, I'm inspecting via network tools or via some monitoring in the backend. What is costly? Is it one specific part of the data that's going to be fetched from the database? And then I can optimize what do I want to display. And another tactic is keeping the user busy, keeping it engaged, and having some shiny CSS animations that give us the illusion that the loading is faster. Another thing very, very often used is this optimistic update, that if you just want to submit a change in a checkbox or so, and you're confident in 99% of the cases, it's working. And it's very rarely that some disconnect in a database did not let it save. So you can pretend in the front end, the responsive backend is already there, and show it like it worked.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If I were going at this, the first thing that I would want to do is kind of look at all the different endpoints that I'm dealing with and seeing where the data is slow, and then making an assessment about the strategy that I can use, right? Because if you have a call in the beginning that is a huge call that grabs a ton of data, you probably aren't going to be able to display anything initially, right? And then maybe you want to look at breaking up that call so that you can display little you know, bits and pieces that the user might be interested in. Or you could like, I don't know, are there any other like things that you could do on initial load?
Yeah, I mean, initial load, whatever load, it depends. I mean, some data sometimes per user does not really change. So it's more or less static. So you could cache it somehow and have some pre-call that's fetching the data from the last session right away. And such tricks, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Do you ever encounter situations where the calls are just like unpredictable? Like the back end is like, you know, sometimes it's going to respond really quickly, but like in certain cases, it's like, oh, you know, like it's a much longer time. And in that case, like, what do you do about something like that?
Yeah. I've also sometimes done measurements like 10 times loading the same request from the backend. And there was a fluctuation between a second and 15 seconds and so on. And if the backend is not scaling well, if there's no well load balancing and so on, and you cannot do something about it, then I deep dive into backend monitoring and check if I can skip some parts. What's the blocking part of this? Or maybe I even inspect the backend code, depending if we can have a handle on it, to see if there's just an SQL statement that's not fast and that's not performant and
could
be done better. Or just sometimes in backends, even there are parts fetched in a chain synchronously, one after another, while there are possibilities to load something in parallel with asynchronous calls.
Mm. Do you have any tips for like doing the like tools that you use for measuring that performance on the front end and the back end?
In the front end, I use the web developer tools and do some Lighthouse scans and so on. And for the back end, we are very lucky to have some Dynatrace monitoring.
Oh, nice. It's
very, very detailed. It even drills down to single SQL statements. So you do not see no longer this black box like in the web developer tools. Okay, backend takes 5 seconds to return a response, but you really see execution of a function by function, what's going on in the backend.
Yeah, that's great. I find that we have so many tools now for like just general telemetry. Sometimes it can be hard to know, like you have to know where to look, right? Because there's just such a wide variety of tooling. And then also, you know, they provide so much data that I think it's like a really worthwhile investment in terms of developer skill set now. But whenever I've done performance monitoring and performance measurement, I found that it is so important to be able to get a consistent environment. And then also to test different environments if you have that ability, because you know, there are so many factors that go into how fast and slow something is. And oftentimes you can have somebody saying that, you know, your website or your application is running really slowly, and like you don't realize that they are on mobile, or you know, there's some factor that is not being accounted for in your like super beefy environment at what your development environment. So I don't know, there's just like so many factors in performance measurement.
Really many factors, and it's important to decide what is the slow part. Is it the back end or is it the front end? Because the front end is directly blamed, even it cannot do something for it most of the times if the back end is slow. And so at least you can rule out if you have some work to do in the front end, or if it's some back end you might want to mask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
yeah, definitely I'm trying to cut in here. My my internet, like I said, is up and down. But yeah, I definitely feel the pain of getting the UI taking the blame for the back end, because that it's where they see it. Like nobody can see how slow the requests are until that shows up on the front end and people are like, where's this data? Why is it taking so long? So definitely.
And I mean, in the front end, many things go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Like bad, poorly written code, inefficient code, even just getting the order of requests incorrect, or if you make like a blocking loading state, like a block, I have this data, but I'm going to put it in a loading state until I get it again. there's things we can obviously do on the front end too that are just as cause just as many problems.
Yeah, I mean, a classic is three UI components in the same applications, all showing the same data, which rarely changes, and they are all fetching it again and again, and no reuse, no central state management in place to share the data.
So on the topic of state management, do you have a preferred state management strategy?
I try to keep it as simple as possible, to be honest, because in most applications, if they are not too large, you can live with some service-based state management. So I rather have it simple than have a lot of Redux-style boilerplate, which is complex, and some, especially new programmers coming to the project, might not know the syntax and might guess some code and introduce some bugs which are not needed just because this boilerplate is confusing.
Yeah, I think anytime you're adding complexity or just abstraction to what you're doing in the code, it can be confusing. And there's also, like, with something like NGRX, I like it as a tool, but it does take training to get people to use it correctly and to keep them from making some pretty common mistakes. But even with a service, like service with a subject, something that can retain the state of the request for you and play those back until you can get the fresh data. So when you're talking about optimistic updates, like what are some of the places where you feel like those are most valuable?
Yeah, just for example, imagine a web shop and having some add to my wish list button or some like button or some star button in an application, some user preference to be saved, which just need to be set as a label somewhere in the database. And this rarely fails because it cannot be sold out in the background or something. It's just marking something.
Yeah, and that gives the user a better experience then, because they can immediately see their action. There's no loading spinner like, hold on, I'm going to like your thing. Hold on. So I think the one place I've seen optimistic updates go awry is we were working on a shopping cart app. And if you clicked the add button like a bunch of times, it wasn't ganging up those requests. So it would send them off individually. And then as they each came back, it was like decrementing and incrementing and decrementing and incrementing. And it was very confusing.
Oh my gosh.
Shopping carts are the worst. Especially I worked once for a web shop where you have single items of stock left. And you have to make sure that you cannot reserve the same item for more than one user. So you have to be careful calculating how many items.
Oh, wow. I've actually never worked on a shopping cart before. That's really interesting. I just realized that. But yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of complexity.
Mm-hmm. Because then you have to, like, you can save the cart between visits, and you want your cart on the app to show the same things as if you log in on the website. And there's some weird state complexity there. And then if you are dealing with with stock, like trying to keep track of actual stock.
Yeah.
We were the place I worked for was a grocery store. So they just did the thing where they'd say, oh, you ordered taco sauce, but instead we're going to give you this weird sour cream.
I would be so disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially
my entire online shopping experience.
It's especially risky when you make the payment, because then you have to make sure that the item in stock is really going to that user and cannot be sold at the same time in parallel.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Yeah. All that is so stressful. Like, I can't imagine. I don't know why this is just making me think about like something like eBay, where it's like the having to deal with updating bidding and stuff. Okay. Now we're just going down a whole different can of worms. I guess in those cases, you need your APIs to be like super fast and like you have different connections, of course. To, like, you wouldn't be making REST requests probably, but
Catherine, I was hoping that you could share with us some like patterns, like CSS patterns that you prefer for you know, improving perceived performance.
Yeah, first and foremost, we should use CSS and not JavaScript to do animation, because it's single threaded and you do not want to slow down your front end by doing some nice animations to gain some time, then you would lose it. So, and my favorite are really transitions, CSS transitions, to make it alive. And what I like most is this kind of skeleton animation with some movement. So I sometimes call it shimmer animation.
Yeah.
It's basically a fluid left to right background transition, a movement, making this more alive, the skeleton.
Okay. So I usually prefer that too. I heard recently that they are, this is a silly thing to share because I'm not sure what the alternative is, but I heard that they're like kind of going out of style, which I was surprised about. But I think that the important thing to me about a skeleton animation that I really love is that it takes up the, you know where like all of the things that are on the page are being laid out, like that retains the same layout. And you kind of get a sense for like what is going to be there in a little bit. If you just have kind of blocks that don't really have any elements on them, or you are dramatically shifting the layout around, I think it can be really jarring for a user, especially if you're just updating something instead of, just initially loading it.
Well, and you'll get dinged for performance on that too, right? Like
if
you've got a lot of layout shift or,
and it's an SEO issue now too, right? Cause I think that
content layout shift is counted. You have to use it carefully, and you have to also think about carefully, how is my layout arranged? How big are my blocks? Because the worst thing I have seen is in this trendy microfondant area, that are three widgets, one and another between the header and the footer. And at first header and footer are collapsed. And then in the middle, there are three different sprinters starting, and then widgets are loading one after another. So I would say also outer layout, positioning, frame is very important to consider.
I think we've all been on websites where we go to like, I just want to read this article, and then it loads, but then it pops up something like, oh, you need to sign in. And then it's like, oh, now you got to click here to read more.
Yeah.
And then if you do that, then it breaks and you see a white screen, but it's like,
gosh, it drives me crazy.
There's a lot of, oh gosh, like there's so many just sort of poorly designed for user experience, because in the end, like, we just want the user to enjoy using our website, right? Or the app, like that's sort of the whole point.
Yeah.
I
kind of think about it as like an experience, right? Like you have this, sort of portal that the user is using to get something done or get some information or something like that. And whether you design it intentionally or not, you are creating an experience for them. And you have to like go through it yourself and like see, is this the way that somebody who is like coming to my application potentially like dozens, hundreds of times a day wants to experience like receiving this information? I don't know. It's kind of like a perspective shift that I think every developer needs to make, to being like just a user instead of like seeing it from their developer eyes and being like, well, this is this way because, you know, this backend call is like not it's slower or whatever. Like the user doesn't care about any of that. Like they're just coming and trying to accomplish their goal.
Yeah. And be a little bit impatient and try to double yeah. somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm definitely that user.
Yeah, I find a lot of bugs, so right. I'm very impatient and click everywhere, click the save button and hope it works.
Mm-hmm. Right. As a user, it can be very frustrating. And I think I like to always go back to nobody cares what your excuse is. Like if you're late or if you didn't do something, like nobody really cares. And so if your website is slow, nobody cares what your excuse is.
That's harsh advice, but true.
Right? And especially the user experience should be the most important. And I've often seen it's another way around. So there are managers deciding how the page is cut into four different micro frontends. Then they think about some architecture. And no one cares about the composition. So I would say the composition, the overall product should be in focus.
Yeah, I think it's easy for teams to really just focus on the parts that they own, right? And we really have to think about the app holistically. So one of the things that Angular has that I feel like it's Angular's bad reputation is bundle size. So what are some of the things that, the Angular, so it's not as bad as it used to be. It used to be significantly worse, but what are some of the things that we can think about to help reduce bundle size? Because a lower bundle size is going to mean a faster application load.
Yeah. I mean, the most prejudice that Angular has a big bundle size does not hold true when you compare a full-blown application with another one of a different framework, because Angular is a full all-in-one package. And if you start using Vue.js or React, which are UI only, and you sum up the parts you need to have some routing, to have some state management and so on, you get comparable bundle sizes. And I mean, having only a single Angular bundle and not multiple is helping also a lot, because as I said, it's so trendy to decide, let's do micro frontend, let's have multiple web components with different Angular versions on the same page, and just for the sake of having the most independent teams. And this is really hindering performance. If you cannot agree on a good architecture, trying to minimize the bundles to have a single instance.
Oh, definitely not using micro front ends when you don't have to is like, it's the bottom line, right?
Don't say that it's legacy if you are not going with the trends and have micro front ends everywhere. Yeah.
Right. I feel like you can have a legacy app that you just developed last year. It just kind of depends on what you've done to it, right?
So, I kind of wish that I wish that people could see their applications as like a physical form. Like when you look at, something that's like,
I'm just imagining a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you see like something that has like, you know, React and Vue and like multiple versions of Angular kind of like all put together with all the frameworks. And like, you look at it and you're like, oh my goodness, like this is such a patchwork, like blob of things. And then you might inspired to like make it a little simpler.
Yeah. Sometimes I do it. Sometimes I make a screenshot of the application and then I draw some rectangles to illustrate the cuts, and you have this injected in that. And here we go. And often what also helps is doing some bundle size analysis, some composition visualization. And for example, I could convince one of the teams contributing to the app to skip that Moment.js library, which is so huge that it's almost like Angular. It's just for date formatting. And even it helps already if you strip out all the locals you do not need, because that's making the bundles so huge.
Yeah.
I feel like my connection is the manifestation of a bad app.
It is kind of like fitting for this episode because, well, there's nothing we right. can really do about it, but
yeah, you have to right. do the best of what you have.
Right. I'm like, I'm giving you the perceived performance by just trying not to talk. But I was going to say that that is something that when we, when Angular switched to compiling with Ivy, we do get tree shaking. So if it's a library in the Angular core that's not being used, it does get tree shaken out. So that definitely helps reduce bundle sizes. And then I recently learned that they are going through and making all of the, you know, it's like if you need to use ngif, or in the router directive, if you need to use router link, those are actually standalone directives at this point. So you no longer have to even pull in the entire module. You can just pull in the directives that you need. And so I think that's a really unique feature of Angular because of the way it does compilation, that we can leverage that to help reduce bundle sizes. I know the team has worked, they've heard everyone's complaints that, you know, that we need to reduce bundle sizes. Are there some common like pitfalls that you see with when people are setting up their applications that they do that could help improve performance from the beginning? So like if you're setting up a new application.
Yeah. Especially around making it configurable or having different locales. I've seen many things. I mean, Angular and Angular Localize supports having speedy builds per locale optimized, where you can have your JSON files with all your translations and you get one bundle per locale and it's pre-compiled and all the texts are in there and it's super fast. And sometimes out of no real reason, people start to have some runtime locale injection instead of using what's already there. And this is slowing down then the application. And also the configurable, okay. configurable everywhere, having a runtime configurations loaded at the startup of the app, just for the sake of having it speedy configurable, is often slowing down. And I mean, in our most recent apps, we use a trick basically, where we use environment variables with some placeholders, and we build the bundle. Mm-hmm. And then running the deployment, a deployment script will take some Helm chart values and replace those placeholders at deploy time. So it takes less than a minute. And we have those configurations in there, which are before just environment parameters. And this is super fast. And we can change those Helm charts and have a redeployment within a minute with new values. And the advantage is we have one single build of the whole package. So we do not have to worry that our dev deployment, our demo deployment, and our production deployment have different builds because we're using the same code and just replace those placeholders.
That's nice. Yeah. I can definitely, that sounds, I'm like taking notes, scribbling furiously over here. But yeah, cause I think like when you make a bad decision at the beginning, the problem with performance issues like that is you won't notice it right away. Like it doesn't seem like a big deal until you're like 3 years down the road and you've got a whole new team of developers and they're pulling out their hair. Like, why did they do this? Why is it like this? So that's a really great tip to do it that way.
You should always question for any runtime configuration. This I would already question at the beginning if it's really needed or not. Yeah. Yeah. Other
like, especially with localization.
Yeah, and localization, especially sometimes I've even seen runtime localization, even though the application was running in one language. Why do you introduce complicated localization if you don't need it?
We're planning on doing it eventually.
Yeah. So just making the code more complex than needed. Yeah. And also tracking is another thing. I've seen so many blocking app initializers just setting up some tracking, which is not helping the user using the product and just side value for some analysis. So this shouldn't be blocking.
Yeah,
and definitely beginning architecture plays a role. Like I told, don't use as many cut micro fondants as possible if you do not have to.
Right. Yeah, it's like the Yagni principle, like you aren't going to need it, like keep it simple, you know, like all those things. And I know like as developers, a lot of us, like we have complicated brains and we can come up with the most complex, complicated solutions.
Just to impress people.
yeah, exactly. Like, look at this. It's terrible. It's a Rube Goldberg machine. and then, you know, as you advance in your career, you're like, okay, how can I make this more simple? I actually don't need all this fancy.
Yeah. Eventually you get tired of explaining how, how your complex Rube Goldberg machine works. And you're like, well, maybe we should just make this more simple so that everybody can understand it.
Yeah, that's actually the funniest thing I've learned over my years of experience, and that the more experience I get, the more I keep care of making it simple, making it readable and maintainable for everyone, and not doing it as complex as possible just to pretend I'm a clever guy and I can write complex code.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, like, I think that it takes a while to learn how to do things that simply. So it kind of follows the natural curve of like experience with being a developer. Because I think most people, as they discover more complexity, they subconsciously explore it. And so their solutions become more and more complex because they're accounting for all these different scenarios and edge cases and things like that. But, as you become more experienced, I think you learn to which edge cases and scenarios you really do need to account for. You know, I'm also thinking of like writing documentation. Sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent, but writing documentation, like it's difficult to make it simple and understandable. It's kind of like a,
yes,
I don't want to say it's an art, but it kind of is an art. I don't know.
And to make it findable, that's another aspect.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And not outdated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We always have discussions where to place the documentation in the code as some markdown document or in some Confluence. And yeah.
Yeah. Katrin, I was wondering also if you had a take on, like I've had a few experiences where I was developing something like an interface and, you know, it's not sort of the fault of the back end, but I have certain scenarios that I don't account for in the first iteration of that interface. For example, like specifically having way more data than I initially expected. So I like, you know, if I have a list of items, and I'm developing it expecting there to be like 30 items. And then, you know, somebody comes in, they have 3,000 items and my interface completely breaks in that scenario. Do you think there are, or do you have any like tips for sort of accounting for that or thinking with that mindset beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, it always helps to get some realistic data refinement information upfront and to talk to your backend colleagues to define the API together.
Yeah.
Not just blindly code some frontend and then hope it connects to the backend. Yeah. And for sure, it can always also be factored, but you have to align with your backend colleagues and make sure nothing breaks and that it's backwards compatible, or you have a strategy, which one to change first, front end or back end. And then for sure also to think about if your backend can help you pre-formatting data as far as possible. So serving as a backend for front end and not doing the complex stuff in the front end alone.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a big important thing is like, what is the responsibility of the front end versus the API?
Yeah. So it all comes back to what Lara and I were talking about earlier, like the number one skill as a developer is not anything technical, but communication.
Right.
It's the, yeah, it's the baseline.
and questioning requirements and yes, if it's really helping in the long run. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm, definitely. So to pivot a little bit, I know there's a lot of talk. So Angular uses Zone.js to basically do change detection. And so there's always talk out there about, okay, well, that slows down Angular. What about if we just run without it? So what are your thoughts on running without Zone.js?
Yeah, again, like the complex state management, avoid it if you can. If if you have something you really need to optimize to the very last piece, yeah, then you can do it, but do it carefully. But don't do it as a first choice everywhere, because it has some risk. And I mean, Angular is prepared to keep your state consistent. And if you turn it off, it's up to you taking care of your state.
Yeah, except at that point, then you have to handle, I'm going to mark this for check. You have to manually run change detection everywhere. So that can be pretty complicated. But yeah, I think it's interesting, though, that there are just sort of all these different ideas about what we can do to optimize. One thing, though, that I think is really interesting, too, is what you just said, you know, like with a feature, push back on requirements. Like if you don't really, you know, we have UX teams a lot. Some teams have UX teams, some teams don't. I also find that I've been on teams where you have one person that's like, I need this feature. I want everything to have infinite scroll. And people are like, but what, like, is that what the user wants? And, you know, and so it's like, I think it is really important to dig in and understand the problem you're actually trying to solve instead of solving problems that don't exist. But
yeah, it's always helpful to have some real users to check your system on some demo environment and to get some feedback, to get some real user testing, and to see what are the challenges, where are they stuck in the application, and what's really bugging them. And often it's not what some of the managers has on their top prior list.
Yeah, definitely. And even on my own priority list, like I've definitely found myself working on a feature and I think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I could do this, if it could be like this, and then you bring it to somebody that actually uses the app and they're like, yeah, I would never do that. Why would I do that? You know, but so it's important to understand what your app is doing and how your users are using the application. And like you said, finding the pain points, because I think the pain points are exactly what they are. Those are the things that people take away and have a bad feeling about your application. So do you have strategies? So if you're trying to locate pain points, you said working with users, or do you have other strategies that you use?
I do these lighthouse scans and check all my pages and see if there are technical measurable slowdowns, and that something is blocking, that something has some layout shift and so on. And do this regularly, once a month or so, depending on how many features you change, to get a feeling if you introduced something which is slowing down your application. So this can help as a quality check.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and you can build that into your CI/CD pipeline even if you
exactly
want
yeah
to. So yeah, I feel like CI/CD pipeline and like checks and stuff, that's where you can just like go a little crazy about like, I'm going to add Lighthouse, and I'm also going to do this. I'm also going to have like a comprehensive end-to-end suite. I'm also going to have a sonar scan run. I'm also going to have this, like, that's where it's a good place to be a little complicated, because that's when you can catch, you know, like bundle size creep or just like a new performance issue that comes up. Because it is hard to just fully test the entire app manually as you're developing in it. So I feel like automated tests. Are there any other automated like tests or scans that you like to run to help with performance?
Yeah, not directly with performance, but as you said, sonar scan is a must-have in all projects to detect any smelly code. I like the brain bug, that it's a brain overload and too complex to maintain. And
oh, yes,
this might also already be an indication. And yeah, for sure, you can also have your end-to-end tests, and you could also measure here timings if some click path is growing in length, and mm-hmm. it takes longer on the same system, on the same power to get through.
Yeah, or if you have a new request that is always timing out or something too, like that would be another good indication. Yeah, I like the like to get back to sonar. The cyclomatic complexity, that is always the one.
Yeah, yeah, that's my favorite.
You know, you're in a legacy app when your cyclomatic complexity is over 25. So, if you're not familiar with cyclomatic complexity, it's how many different routes you can take through a method. If you've got a lot of like switch statements or even optional chaining, each chain, each switch statement, each conditional leads to another end result for your application or for that method to resolve. So
I see.
Yeah. So it's kind of, it's got a cool name. So it's like cyclomatic, like that just, it just sounds really like, it sounds really cool. So, but yeah, I think it's important to keep an eye on that stuff, because that is going to impact, the end result can be that it impacts the user, but that immediately impacts the developer. Because if I open up a file that's got five methods and each one has a cyclomatic complexity over 20 or something, it's a lot to take in and work on, which means I'm going to be developing features slower. I'm going to be releasing features slower. And probably I'm going to be skimping on some of my unit tests, because it'd take forever to get the test coverage and, you know, to test all those edge cases. So, and frankly, yeah. I'm guessing you probably couldn't even, I've definitely run into those where there's unreachable code as well, where there's no way to test it because it's, you never.
Yeah, and it's already almost a guarantee from a certain complexity to figure out there's a smell in state handling. There is some state dead end where you end up in a situation the state is broken.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. When you find a state that just gets mutated everywhere, like I think one of the biggest pet peeves I have are void methods that just mutate things. And they get sort of hidden everywhere. And then as a developer, I'm trying to go through and figure out where the thing got changed, and it's buried like five methods in. And, but that can also, you know, that leads to like mutation. That can also affect your user experience, because if you turn on push change detection on because you've heard, oh, well, that's one way I can speed up performance, I'll use on push change detection. But then you're mutating objects instead of creating new object references and passing them in as inputs, change detection's not going to pick that up. And so there's definitely tools out there that exist that you have to know how to use. And I would say it's on push. And like, if you're ever thinking, I'm going to take Zone.js out, like, I really hope you know what you're doing.
Yeah. And I'm always telling, if you don't have any unit tests at all, always testing what happens on init, what's my initial state, what are my attributes, and how are they changing by some method evocation. And that's really, there you find always some surprises.
Yes, definitely. Oh gosh, we had, I worked on a project once where there was this, it was a method that was all over the application because it got copied and pasted, but it was update query params. And so like anytime anything happened, it would go and update the query parameters. It was so confusing to debug because it was just, you know, everything was always like, oh, I did a thing, I better go update the query parameters. But it was just like sort of constant struggle to try to maintain the state of the application the way it was intended to be. And it was really just a very complicated solution to a much more simple problem. So,
Yeah, but that's also a classic to have the query params to make everything bookmarkable and to keep some minimum state over all pages. Yeah.
And I'm actually a fan of sort of driving requests from the query parameters, but you have to follow the same, like it, you can't just adjust them. There can be no adjust query parameters. You have to, when the thing happens, that's when the change, like that's when you push the change to the query parameters, and then whatever is in, like in making the request is listening to changes only in the query parameters. And I think where where that fails is when people are like, oh, I'll update the query parameters and I'll invoke the method that does the change. Like, no. It can only be one direction.
Yeah.
Unidirectional here, people.
So. That's one thing that I think shaping your mental model around that is more complex when you're, you know, when you're first introduced to that concept of like, you know, because the cycle changes so much I think that's definitely something that people need to pay attention to when they're first learning it.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, I have to just point out here, I think that my connection, I'm cursing it, but I feel like my connection is better. So the longer we've talked about performance, I feel like my Wi-Fi router is like, yeah, maybe I should get my, it's been doing some work.
like inspiring it.
It's like, an, yes, I'm inspired.
I know I can do it.
Better. You can do it, little Wi-Fi router. So was there anything else that you have top of mind that that you like to do related to performance or anything with Angular? With Angular, that's with your applications.
As I said, I like these shimmer animations and so on. I would always advise to have a look at the index HTML.
Oh.
Often index HTML is just forgotten. It's empty. Nobody does anything with it. And
it's true.
You can have some quick wins placing something there.
Okay. So what's your recommendations for the index.html?
Yeah, maybe you have some static preview of your website. Maybe you're a public website, you don't have a login or so, and you can display something already before something complex is loaded, or you have some pre-placeholder without the dynamic elements and make it as similar as possible to what's coming. And it's a chance to optimize.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, index.html, it's HTML. It's already HTML. Our browsers already know how to read that. So they don't have to wait for the JavaScript to tell it.
Yeah. And you can place some CSS upfront in there. So you do not have to wait until the other CSS is coming.
Okay. I like that strategy. Yeah. I feel like index.html, like I know it's there and I very rarely touch it. So, because you don't really need to, but so that's an interesting strategy. And then you would want to, of course, make it as close to what's coming, because then you would get dinged if the page shifts, right? So,
Or at least have your spinner or skeleton or whatever already in there before all the bundle is loaded and then starts to render spinner.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I like that idea. And I love that you brought up the CSS animations. I feel like CSS is sort of like the unsung hero of the internet. I will admit I'm a very basic CSS user. Like I can make it work, but if you have to solve a tough CSS problem, I don't recommend that you ping me for the answer, because I'm not going to have it. But, there's just so much to it. I mean, even just like leveraging pseudo classes there's all these parts of CSS that are just already sort of baked into the browser that we can take advantage of. So thank you for pointing that out with the animations, because that does make a lot of sense.
And you can easily gain some 100 milliseconds by doing an animation. For example, you click on a button and the call after the button got clicked is costly. So the backend takes a while to process it. And you do some nice transition animation on hover, going for a duration of 300 milliseconds, shrinking and growing the button a little bit. And it keeps the user busy. And nice. you gain 300 milliseconds.
It's the dancing baby of like, so instead of having like the distraction, like in the 90s, there was like the dancing baby thing that was everywhere. Like,
I don't know what you're talking about.
There are at least 5 listeners out there that know exactly what I'm talking about. But, you know, like in the early internet days, I feel like early web design was all about distracting your user, right? Like, don't worry about it taking so long. Instead, enjoy this like weird animation we've made. And so yeah. I like that idea that you can use CSS, which is just kind of doing its thing in the browser, to trick your user into thinking stuff is happening. Because stuff is happening. It's just hard to indicate it in a way that makes people feel less impatient.
For sure, the patient also depends if the users are already engaged or not. And sometimes it's also very valuable to keep them busy, giving them something to read. Like, for example, you do a payment, and this is often the slowest thing you can do. And just write according with your spinner, and that the payment is processed in a secure way, and therefore the user is patiently waiting. And
I like that pattern too. Just give them some tips for like, you know, something that they didn't know about your site or
Yeah. And I think that too, like then I think you can also sort of strategize like the order that things happen too. Like if you know that this part of the request is really slow, like what can you give them ahead of time? Maybe what does your app already have? You know, like I've at the grocery store, for example, loading all of the details about a product took a while, but we had some of it, you know? So it's like, we could start them out with a fair amount of data that it may at least made it look like, oh, you've made it to the detail page. Don't worry. I'm getting those ingredients for you. I'll be right there. You know, it's, so giving them what you have, I think ahead of time too, can really help improve performance. And
yeah, or knowing your order number right away, because you know it, and then you will store the order in background. And if you really can rely on your system, you can display something.
Yeah, I think that's smart. Well, cool. I think this is such an important topic because it is really like, it honestly, it doesn't even matter what framework you're using, whether you're using Angular, whether you're using Vue or React or you know, none of that, right? It's so important to give your user a good experience and to improve the performance and just the workings of the app. Because nothing is more frustrating than, especially like when you're building applications, like internal applications for your colleagues or even like just customers that where they're trying to do work in your application. It is so frustrating to feel like it's a laggy experience where you're always waiting. And so I think it's such an important topic. And I think you've given us some really good tips to think about. If the user, so I think your talk from NGDE is online.
On YouTube, it should be.
Yeah. So we'll make sure and include that in the show notes because you had some great code examples in that. And obviously on the podcast, it's a little difficult to display code examples. but I do remember really enjoying the talk that you gave there and it, just really some great tips. And everyone I was sitting with was like, oh yeah, you know, everyone was nodding around. You know, it's a good talk when everyone is in the room nodding with you. So we'll go ahead and get that in the show notes. Otherwise, if somebody wanted to reach out to you, what is your preferred way for people to reach out to you?
LinkedIn, I would
say. Okay. And we'll have a link for that in the show notes as well. Do you have any other talks coming up? Do you have anything booked for this year or just working on just going faster and
going faster. I mean, classics of myself are also testing in Angular because I learned it the hard way from scratch without switching to different testing frameworks to understand when is my DOM ready, what am I actually testing, and this is very valuable. And also talking a lot about architecture of this micro front end, macro front end, library composition, module federation, and also this web component packaging and combining Angular versions and what can go wrong. So these are the topics recently. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have, are those talks that you've given or that you have scheduled to give?
I gave some, but I'm scheduled now in EnterJS in June, and then see maybe Developer Week in Nuremberg again, and something in the fall, but not yet decided.
Okay, wow, all right,
you're busy.
Yeah, definitely. And so, and I think it's great too. I love having you on the show as well. There's such a vibrant community in Europe. And I just think it's really great, that we have this, since we're online, we have this format where we can kind of all share ideas across the world. And so I think that's really cool. So we'll get some of those links in the show notes. And I just want to thank you so much for taking your time to join us. I know it's, must be where are you at in Germany?
In Munich.
Munich. Okay. Yeah. So it's, what is it about, what time is it there?
It's now 8:15 in the evening. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. So you probably had dinner. I'm ready for lunch. But I thank you for taking your evening to join us today. It was wonderful speaking with you. And to the listener, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah. Thanks. Talk to you.
Hey, this is Preston Lam, one of the NG Champions writers. In our daily battle to crush out code, we run into problems, and sometimes those problems aren't easily solved. NGConf broadcasts articles and tutorials from NG Champions, like myself, that help make other developers' lives just a little bit easier. To access these articles, visit medium.com/NGConf.
Thank you for listening to the Angular Plus Show, an NGConf podcast. We would like to thank the NGConf organizers, Joe Eames and Aaron Frost, our producer, Brianne Smithia, our sponsors, and our podcast editor and audio engineer, Patrick Hayes. You can hire him and find him everywhere on social media at Pat John Hayes. This podcast was mixed and mastered by Spoonful of Media. You can find out more information about their work and the services that they offer by going to spoonfulofmedia.com.